Welcome to the New York Now podcast, a modern wholesale market for retailers and specialty buyers seeking diversity and discovery. Gathering twice a year in America's design capital, New York City, it's where buyers and designers unearth a refreshed and dedicated collection of eclectic lifestyle products.
Welcome to the New York Now Spotlight podcast. I'm Amy Loewenberg, Relations and Partnership Development Manager at New York Now, and I'll be bringing you important information, conversations, and perspectives from both sides of the aisle. I treasure the relationships I've established, and I relish in the new ones I make every day, sharing information and introducing our amazing community of retailers, buyers, vendors, artists, and makers through my Spotlight podcast at New York Now and my store tours on Instagram. Today, we're going to meet artist and veteran photojournalist and founder of 185, Robert Stolarek. 185 is a Brooklyn-based wood shop offering a variety of handcrafted wood products, eclectic and one-of-a-kind pieces that will add a vintage feel to your environment. An award-winning photographer, Robert was a regular contributor to the New York Times for 20 years. Born in New York City, he began his journalism career covering conflicts and general news in the United States, Europe, Latin America, and the Balkans. For the past decade, Robert has focused his reporting on social and criminal justice issues, including groundbreaking coverage of stop and frisk policies, hurricanes Katrina and Sandy, the Haitian earthquake, and the unrest in Ferguson and Baltimore. Robert started 185 after spending years building his own home accessories. His unique aesthetic combines romantic notes with vintage wares. While Robert creates with his Brooklyn home in mind, his craftsmanship is influenced by an extensive career that has taken him all over the world. Robert is full of spirit, which you will hear as he shares with us his photojournalistic life and how he's moved into his second career. He is a very interesting man, and I couldn't be happier to have met him and to have played a part in his journey to exhibiting at New York Now, and actually exhibiting anywhere for the first time. So let's get to know Robert. So Robert, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me here.
I totally want to dive into your New York Now experience as a first-time exhibitor and talk with you about your handcrafted products. But first, I think we need to learn just a little bit more about you. You are a talented artist in many ways. You create a variety of handcrafted items for personal use and the home, but you're also an accomplished photojournalist, and you have a pretty grand resume that has taken you into some hard circumstances and environments where you've recorded the aftermath of significant and cataclysmic events and very adeptly shared with us the human experience. How did you get started on this path?
Well, I was young. I wanted to be a chef. My father owned restaurants, and I worked in restaurants almost all of my young life. And when I was around 20, I don't know, 20 something years old, young in college, my sister got a computer for Christmas. It's kind of how it started. My sister got a computer for Christmas, and my mom felt bad that she, you know, I didn't need a computer. It was back in the days when nobody had computers. So my mom bought me a camera for Christmas. And I always wanted to paint. I was a painter while I was working in restaurants. I thought I fancied myself kind of like this artist. I had a loft in Soho. I had these giant canvases that I painted on. And I really wasn't very good at being a painter. It really frustrated me because I liked like artists like Salvador Dali and this surrealism. And I was incapable of doing it. And it really was the most frustrating time in my life, you know, for art. And sure. So I started shooting pictures and I traveled. So at a pretty young age, I took off and would take breaks off from college and go away and travel. And I was like, when I went to go travel, I didn't want it to just be with a bunch of friends and see things. I went away on my own. I brought this camera. I brought, 400 foot reels of film, black and white film that I hand rolled in closets all around Europe. And I headed east first to go see my family for the first time. I had never met my family. I'd never been really anywhere in the world. And I wanted to cover like the post Cold War life in the former Soviet Union. So I traveled to places like, Poland, Germany, Czech Republic, Slovenska Republic, Ukraine, Russia, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and all the way through down to Turkey, through Romania, Hungary. And I did this, and I worked in this restaurant on the corner of West Broadway in Houston called the Michi Mie. It was a big, you know, it was a spot in Soho. And mm-hmm. It was a place where all these artists came in to visit. And I was a bartender there. And all these famous artists would come to the, you know, bar, and I got to know them. Like Arturo DeMonaco was a regular customer of mine. And Alberto Riso, a famous fashion photographer. And when I came back from this trip, I had all these pictures, and I was in school at Stony Brook University. And I developed all the film myself. It was part of my senior thesis. I developed all the film, and I got myself an exhibition at Flowers, upstairs at Flowers, at a restaurant I was working at. And it was really great. I was standing behind the bar bringing these pictures every weekend and sharing them with, like, Arturo and with Alberto and other people that were there. And they were like,
amazing.
This stuff is really good. And they really helped me, you know, to develop the sense that these were good pictures and these were something worthy of showing. And so I did the first exhibition, and a lot of these people came to it. My professors came to it. My friends came to it. And I was kind of excited. I was looking at more from, you know, I guess I was getting more into doing art photography more than it was like journalism. I didn't really understand the difference at that stage of my life. I wasn't like schooled in this. So I was like getting into it, but I really liked the concept of travel. And I liked the concept of shooting. And I was like, I'm going to continue to do this. I think I want, and I started doing a little more research and seeing what it was that I could possibly do. And I thought, oh, I want to be a war correspondent. And often I had these ideas, and they were kind of a, you know, crazy ideas to my family and friends, because I was sort of lazy, sort of, you know, I worked in restaurants, I was a bartender.
Listen, I know about working in restaurants, not personally, but because of family members. And that is not a lazy industry by any means.
I was lazy in it, though, but I worked. But I was good. I mean, I did a good job. I had a good background of food. So I worked in all these great places. Amici was where I was at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I was going to go to South America the following year. And I was going to drive a motor. I had met a girl in Europe the year before, and she lived in Argentina. And I was going down to visit her. And I was going to drive my motorcycle from New York to Argentina. And I was going to document like the children of Central America. So that was like kind of the idea. I didn't really have a direction to what I was doing. It was kind of whimsical. And I was like, I'll do this because it'll kind of make sense for me to be on this motorcycle trip. So in November of 1994-5, right. I got on a motorcycle from the corner of St. Mark's and 2nd Avenue and drove south. I just kept driving until, you know, wow. I couldn't drive anymore. And I documented all of this. I got very sick on the road. And I ended up coming back to New York early after 5 months on the road. I was supposed to be gone for like years, and I never made it down to all the way to South America at that point. I made it to Nicaragua. And when I came back, somehow I put together another show, the City of New York, along with, I think it was the Mary Anthony Gallery. There was a guy named Tom Maitland, who also was a customer to Michi Mie. And he was like, I'm going to get you this combined show. It was like a group show in the city. And I did this group show, like this big, you know, group show for the City of New York. I then got another show at La Mamala Galleria, which was this older man that ran that gallery. And he was like, it was another group show. I never did anything single. And then another show came where I was doing it at Ozone Gallery. And I was kind of excited, you know, like anything. It was new. Mm-hmm. And I was like excited. But I really was feeling like, you know, I don't really want to do gallery shows, and I don't want to be an artist in this sense. I really want to be a photojournalist. And I was really getting into it. And the motorcycle trip kind of defined, I was like, if I could do that and be on the road, then I feel like I'd be okay in a war zone. I came back and nothing was going in that direction. Everything was going in the art direction. And then I started working. I lived in the East Village at the time, and I was covering like the parks and like, you know, like the police and the city, yep, were taking over these local gardens. Yep. And I was working for like the Villager and the Downtown Express the next thing I knew. And that was my first newspaper jobs. And then I was like, I really wanted to work for like more of a daily, you know, cool newspaper in addition. And I got signed on somehow to El Diario La Prensa, which I later became staff photographer at. And I was getting the cover every single day. I was going out to crime scenes all over New York on a motorcycle, a little dirt bike. And I would just go and shoot, and I have like hundreds of covers from there. And then I was out, yeah. I was outgrowing it a little, and I really still wanted to be a war correspondent, and I really couldn't figure out how that would happen. So I decided that in 1999, the Kosovo conflict was happening, and I was like, I need to figure this out. And I put our family pretty much in debt. I charged like bulletproof vests and helmets and plane tickets and all that. And I went to all these different agencies around New York and asked them if AP and AFP, like all these places, to see if they would work with me. And everybody was like, you're going to get killed, kid. You know, it was a different thing. So nobody would send me. And then I finally spoke to somebody from EPA, which is European Press Photo Images. And it's actually a European press agency. And there was a woman there. I think her name was Christiana Sinsala. And she said to me, I will look at your photos when you get there, which was, I felt like that was like, I got signed. I'm going.
What was it? You're in.
So I went and I flew there. I flew to Greece, and then I took a train up through Macedonia, and I was on my own, and I didn't really know anybody in the photojournalist world. I was a restaurant guy, and I was like trying to feel it out. And I just shot all these pictures of like refugees going, and I tried to cross into the border into like, I wanted to get to Pristina, but it was just too dangerous. And I spent, you know, I don't remember exactly how long. I want to say 2 months. Mm-hmm. At this point, I had just gotten married. So I was married in March. In April, I was in Kosovo. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I went to Albania. I went to Macedonia. And then I came back. The portfolio of images from that were pretty incredible.
They've been amazing.
And I was pretty excited. And part of it really brings me into, I did an exhibition. I set up for an exhibition right after that. And what I saw were a bunch of these posters that were on the walls of like buildings that were blown out and that, you know, that just things that, you know, like were broken down from time in a sense. And when I looked at those, I was thinking to myself, oh, I want to kind of create that in some way. So I I printed in sections on 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper, sections of photographs, and then transferred the pulp onto wood. Wow. And the imagery looked like it was 100 years old. I beat up the wood a little and put it together. And I was like, oh, this is an effect that I really like. And that's the effect that I do with the books.
Wow. Well, this is an amazing segue, because it's very much that your camera and your eye is an extension right to your arms and your hands.
Yeah, I was excited about it. Yeah, it was a cool thing for me. It was like I was looking at it for the first time and saying, this is what I saw. And this is what moved me while I was shooting those things. And I was like, I was into it. I found it extraordinary to not just, you know, I felt like photographs were good in magazines and in newspapers as photographs. But when you were going to do an exhibition and show it somewhere, it needed to be more than that. It needed to be, you know, more three-dimensional in a sense. It needed to have like depth to it that was greater than the depth of the photo itself.
Your life is vastly interesting, from, you know, the streets of Soho in a restaurant, on the back of a motorcycle in Nicaragua, to, you know, heading to Greece. And I mean, to me, it just sounds like you've been going and going and going. It makes perfect sense of where you are right now from where you were. And clearly you're still doing everything along the way. You're still a photographer. You're still taking pictures. You're still, I'm assuming, traveling when you can, right?
Yeah. I mean, all of it. I mean, there's been a lot of hiccups throughout time in it. So when I came back from Kosovo, I was broke and I had to go take a job in a restaurant again. I had to give up photojournalism. I took a job as a manager in a place called Phoebe's in the East Village.
Oh my gosh, do I know Phoebe's?
And I was really excited to have this job and make money. But I always wanted to be a journalist. And in the fall of 2000, September, I worked with a kid. His name was Peter. And he was like young. He was in college. And he was like, he knew that I had traveled and that I did this war and that I had all these pictures. And he was like, oh, I want to go away with you next time you go away. And I'm like, dude, I'm a restaurant guy now. I'm never going away again. And he kept it throughout the year of working with him, the 9 months. He was always like, oh, we got to go somewhere. We got to go somewhere. So I said to him, I was like, okay, if you could figure out a place that would be good for me to go, then maybe I'll consider it. And he had a friend that worked for the United Nations, for the Council of Foreign Relations. And the guy said, there's going to be this thing that the U.S. is implementing called Plan Colombia. Colombia is going to be the next hotspot. There's going to be, you know, there's a civil war there, and the Americans are going to go in and eradicate the, you know, the guerrillas and, and eradicate cocaine. And so I asked my boss, who knew both of us, like two of us working there, and he was a really good guy. His name is Joe DiNicola. And I said to him, I said, listen, I'm going to ask you something. You can say no, because I know I run your restaurant, but can I take off like 6 weeks and go and try to be a journalist again? And he said to me, he was like, I had no idea that you wanted to be a journalist anymore. I thought restaurant was your life. He goes, how could I say no to you? He's like, your job will be here in 6 weeks when you get back, and go. And so I went and I took Peter with me. And when I got down there, I just headed south. I got into it again. I went with two of my friends. We went down and we broke the guerrilla lines in the south of the country. And the Times picked me up at that moment. I flew back to New York 6 weeks later. I met with the foreign bureau chief. And she said, the foreign editor at the New York Times. And she asked me if I would go back and stay there for the New York Times. And it was like a dream come true. Like I was going to be a war correspondent for the New York Times. And I had to go to my wife and to my boss. And first was going to the wife and saying, hey, you think it's okay if I do this? And she was like, absolutely, you need to go. Sure. And I went to the boss next. And I said, I know you gave me the 6 weeks. And he's like, I knew this was going to happen. He's like, I wish you nothing but the best. And I went. And I took off and went to Colombia, and I stayed there from 2000 to 2002 and covered the Civil War, the cocaine trade, the guerrilla, and all of that. And then I went on to Venezuela to cover the coup in 2002. And then I came back to New York and I don't know where to go from there. So.
I mean, I'm truly taken with the path of your life. And you think about who you came in contact with and who said yes and who said, I want to go do this. And just all that spurred you into that last time, like it all fell into place.
But that's this too. I mean, when I look at being this guy who's making books, it was another whimsical thing. I wanted to make birdhouses. That was the concept at the beginning, is I was going to make
birdhouses. That's right. I saw birdhouses on that table. We're going to talk about
that. On the card.
Yeah.
I thought I had this great idea. I drove down to Florida to go visit my parents with my girlfriend. I'm not married any longer. And I had a girlfriend. And we drove down to visit my parents. And we took the old military highway. And on that old military highway coming back home, I was like, I think I'm going to make birdhouses for a living now. I retired, Korean journalist. And she's like, you're going to make birdhouses? I'm like, yeah, I think that's a great idea. And then I came to the realization that you really can't make a living making birdhouses, but that I was going to at least go out and see if people were interested. And I took the birdhouses to a bunch of different stores. And I got out to this place in Greenport, Long Island, called the Weathered Barn. It was like a perfect fit for somebody like me. And I went in there, and the owners, Rena and Jason, are about my age. And she looked at the birdhouses, and she was like, I'm absolutely taking these in the store. And she said, can you make trays? Can you make these? Can you make this? Can you make that? And I really had no idea what I could and couldn't make. And I just was like, this is a great opportunity for me. And I have a little wood shop down in the basement of my home here. And I just started making stuff for her. And she was selling it. And then other people were seeing it. And other people were buying it. But I really, woodwork was great. And I'm still doing it. Yeah. But I wanted to do something that was, you know, a little more artistic. Like something that really, like, I got to kind of realize something, put it together and really have a lot to do with it. Wood was hard to describe what you were doing. Not that the books are easy to describe what I'm doing, but it morphed into me making the journals after there's more to it.
Let's get into talking about your product a little bit. I mean, you've clearly seen our world in its rawest form. And I do see your artistic sense of parallel from your photography to your products. It's very clear to see. And there was something even a little poetic about thinking about how you look through the lens of a camera and see the people who have been broken down by real life events. And then looking at these journals, which we're going to talk about, and how you create them. They're, you know, exposing their framework and their structures. You know, you have a bunch of products. We started just talking about birdhouses, but let's talk about your journal a little bit on dive in a little bit more about this vision of this deconstructed journal.
Okay, so I started doing the journals. The first journal that I ever made was actually a photo book for a colleague of mine at the paper. I shot her wedding. She said to me, can you make me an album for the photos that go in? And I was like, I don't know how to make an album. I know I can't make you an album. And she's a really good friend. And she was like, come on, you're artistic. You can figure it out. And I did. I worked. I remember thinking, how am I going to do this? I can't give her something that's not, you know, good. It has to be as good as everything else that I want to do. I don't want somebody to have something forever and it be like something that's not, you know, that, oh, thank you for the journey, you know, like for the album, but it's, you know, great. And you put it in the corner. So I spent a lot of time learning how to sew these. I had some background in stitching, some background in building stuff. And I just spent a long time trying to build the first, you know, like this first journal in a sense. It's an album, but it's the same technique. And I was really into it. And when I finished making the album, my girlfriend, who's a poet, she was like, oh, can you make me a book for me to, you know, to do my, put my poetry in? And I was like, absolutely, I'm going to make a book for that. And then I started making other books. And then I was like, I wonder if the Weathered Barn would be interested in these books. And I brought a couple of them out to her. And when I brought them to her, she looked at them and she was like, these are the most amazing things I've ever seen. She's like, they look like they were dug up from underground. She's like, that's perfect for this store. And she's like, this is exactly what I want in this. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to spend some time doing this. It's going to be something that I really, you know, this is going to be my focus more than the other things. So I figured out sizing. I use this wonderful paper. I use like a Hanamiel Biblio paper. I wanted to use a heavy watercolor paper, but too heavy a paper is really hard to fold and really doesn't really give that same texture, how it falls and how it ages. So I did some research. I bought this paper. When I was in college, I took a printmaking course, like a lithography course. And I always loved this transfer onto paper and working, tearing it in a deckled edge. So I made sure to find a paper that was affordable and good, like really high quality. And so I got these sheets of paper. I remember doing the first books with it, and it comes 30 inches by 40 inches. And I hand tear it and then score it and then fold it. And there was an issue because the decal is only on one side of this and the decal on the left side is a little bit shorter. So then I realized that you needed to arrange these papers in some way so that the decal is ever present in it. Yep. And that was a task. And I have a chart that I made. And, you know, I remember bringing it up the first time, the chart, to my girlfriend. She's like, what is that? And it had all these letters on it because there were all these different sheets. One says long, one says short, and they're all there. And I follow this chart to this day. There are like seven signatures with three pieces of paper. They all get folded over and then they're, you know, everything's A, B, C, D. And it's got like structure to it. So, you know, it's not only just, it's not, even though it's whimsical, it's still, it's structured in a way.
Yeah.
So then I cut the covers and I was doing more textures. I used glue. I burned the covers first and then I used glue to glue on first layers of paper. And then I use New York Times newspapers for most of it, you know, old newspapers that I keep in boxes. I sort them for colors. I sort them for letters, big letters, small letters, numbers, imagery that has color in it. And I cut out things. I like to be rough with it. I didn't want to be so delicate with it because I burn it and sand it afterwards. So a lot of times I'll see like an image that I like and I'll tear out the shape of it. It's got really rough edges to it. And when I first put it onto the covers, and like the imagery usually comes on the fifth layer, on the final layer. And when I put it on, it looks terrible. And I remember the first time I looked at it, I was like, this is going to look terrible. Yeah. And then I was like, wait, just give it time. Trust it. You know, like I just was like, trust what you're going to do. And then I just sanded it away and then, you know, burned it a little bit more and sanded away more. And I realized the more you sand it away, the less that was left of it was what made it more, you know, like important in a way. Mm-hmm. And then I layer it with this stuff, this mull, it's called. It's to reinforce the spine of books. And I thought when you break apart a book, which I do, I break apart everything that I start with. When I wanted to learn how to dovetail, I would break apart the dovetail and see exactly how this was done. You know, and it's the most important way to learn about something is to rip it apart. And when you rip apart an old book, not that I would tear apart a book for the sake of tearing it apart, but when you see it fall apart, I always kept the journal when I was away and those books have fallen apart. You see this deconstructed nature and I wanted to reproduce that to the truest nature that I could. Something that would start this way, but would be in effect the opposite, something that would last forever instead of something that would fall apart. And that's why I chose to do this external stitch, almost like a Coptic stitch where it's exposed.
I love it. So I actually, yeah, I feel like the longer one owns one of your journals, the more life continues to come out of it, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, like I want it to be precious, but not, I want it to be special, but not precious is the real way. It takes 2.5 weeks to make one of these from start to finish. It's a real process. And I thought, you know, it was often a time where I would think, is there a way to make it less expensive? Is there a way to do this in a way that everybody can have them? And the reality is, there's just no way to do that. You know, there's no way to make this a less expensive item. Truthfully, yeah. It should be more expensive, but I want people to have it. But it just takes a ridiculous amount of time to put together. And yeah. There's a lot of steps.
I can only imagine. But I mean, you do have some other options that you do provide, like your hot foil and your you can customize.
Yeah, I customize them. So there's the newer things that I put together where I can put where it makes it worth it for people. So I'll do custom books and I'll put their names in it. Like I'll hot foil their names into it. I get branding irons, which I brand my own logo into. And originally it was I needed a die to build the thing for the branding. But then I bought a hot foil machine so that it could lower the cost a little and could bring that to people. And it looks beautiful. It's almost like a letterpress that goes into the book. So yeah, I'm trying new things. I'm still relatively new at this and I'm trying new things and trying to make it more accessible.
I think it might be time to share with our listeners how we met.
Yes. So I was so on the weekends in Soho. I went back to Prince Street. When I wanted to do this, I decided that I would be a vendor, that I would go out into the street and sell books and show people what I was doing. So I set up this table with a stitching station. So it's a sewing stand that I built myself. I came to Soho, you know, because it brought me back to my roots, essentially. And I thought, if I'm going to make this grand change in my life from being a photojournalist to being a bookmaker, I wanted to be somewhere where I felt, a foundation of where my life began. In a sense.
Sure.
And so I sew in Soho and lots of people come past me in Soho. Lots of people are, you know, stop by the table. They buy the books. They ask questions. A lot of people are like, oh, can you do this? Can you do that? Oh, I'm going to make you famous. I'm going to make you rich. Everybody says this. And then Amy shows up at the table. Amy was like watching me for a while. I didn't even know what New York Now was. I mean, I didn't know anything about this. And you really were calm and very like just sweet about it. It was a very interesting, your approach wasn't, I'm going to make you rich and famous. Your approach was, I think this is extraordinary. I want other people to see it.
Yeah.
And that was a nice approach. And you gave me your card. And I don't remember how we got in touch again. I think you wrote me again or called me. And I was like, you know, I was nervous about it because I was like, oh, this is bigger than I thought it was. I don't know what to do with this. You said, do you want to do the New York Now? You were going to hook me up with the people who did the handmade version of it. And I was kind of overwhelmed by it, to be honest about it. I was overwhelmed by it. And I was a bit nervous about how I would even go about doing it.
Sure.
You know,
well, we're going to dive into that. But sure. Before we do, I just want to say that I took myself down to Soho because we all go down to Soho, right? And it was a beautiful day. And here I am walking down Prince Street and I saw the tablecloth that you had. It was this red and white toile kind of fabric.
Yeah.
And I saw it before I saw you and what was on it. Because I spotted it a mile away and I personally like red and white toile. So I was like, what is this? And then I just kept getting closer. And then I saw this table with you behind it, like sewing and working with books and this exposed construction and these planters filled with succulents. And I mean, and there you were right in front of 120 Prince Street. It was pretty amazing. And you were actually selling a journal to somebody. And I listened to the way you spoke about your product and I really felt how important it was to you. And I was taken with its beauty. So I couldn't be happier that we met. I couldn't be happier that you were on that street at that time that I was walking down. And jump forward, I introduced you to Allison, the director of the designer maker section for New York Now. And I didn't find out until afterwards that you actually signed on to the market. And I was so excited. So tell us a little bit about that journey.
So it wasn't just Alison. So you had done that, and I went to go look. Alison sent me a bunch of like facts about the show, and honestly, I was just overwhelmed. I'm like a one man show here, and I was like contemplating whether or not I could, if I would have enough time by August to make enough books, which I didn't even know what that number was. Like, how many books do I need to make? And it was like, I had no idea. And I was like, okay, I usually do like, you know, small batch. I do like 25 to, you know, 30 books for the month. If it's a month that I feel like doing it, some months I make less than that. You know, I'm just, you know, it's kind of whatever I feel like doing. And for the show, I was like, I have to make a lot of books. And I also need to try to be out there and show people, you know, like what I'm doing. I still need to be in Soho. So time was an issue. So I called my sister, who is like one of my best friends. And I said to her, I said, I have this opportunity. I met this woman. She reminds me a lot of you. Yeah, you're very similar to my sister in a lot of ways. Just your personality and your warmth. You have a very similar way.
Well, your sister sounds like an amazing woman.
You're both amazing. So this is how I will talk about you for the future after I get to the point of where this brought me. So I went to her and I said, you know, I was offered to do the show. I don't really know much about it and it's expensive and I have the money to do it, but I don't know if I could really afford it. And my sister was like, I think you should do it. I think you're absolutely going to do it. And I'm not going to even let you think about it. And she just wrote me a check. And I had the money, but this is what my sister's like. And my sister just wrote me the check. And then I immediately wrote back to Alison. And I said, I'm going to do it. I guess that was May. And I was going away. I had a trip planned to go to San Francisco all the way down to LA for a film that I'm working on. And I was like, okay, I got to do that. And while I was there, I was all stressed out. I'm like, I only have like 2 months to make all these books. And I'm having a good time with all my friends in California, you know, driving this Pacific Coast Highway and all of this.
My favorite highway.
I never did it before. It's my favorite highway now, too. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah. It's my favorite place to be outside of New York.
It's now my favorite. And I didn't know that. I always hated the West Coast. And then I did this. I went to Big Sur. I did all this. I couldn't believe I'm 52 years old. And it was like a newborn baby in a sense, like experiencing the world for the first time. It was the greatest trip ever. But I was underlying, I was like, I got to get home and make books.
Gotta make the journals.
So I came home and I just put together like a plan. I bought a bunch of wood and I decided that I would set it up in a way that I never did before. I cut all the wood. I cut all the angle on the wood. I laid down the foundation for all of the books and I cut them. And all I did was focus day after day on figuring out what type of covers I was going to do, how they were going to look, what portion of them would be lined paper, which portion would be, blank pages, which ones would be hand sewn pages. And I went through it and I just kept building and building and building. And then the next thing I knew, it was like a week before the show and I still hadn't had an idea of how the booth would look and how, you know, it was maybe 2 weeks before.
Yeah, that was the next thing I was going to ask you. That can be really daunting if you've never done it before. So how did you figure that out?
Well, I'm good with space. I decorate and I build furniture and stuff. And I knew that I wanted to, so I had spoken to people about it and I wanted to kind of bring Soho to like the Javits Center. And I was like, I'm going to, you know, the central part is all about me sewing, but I usually have a pretty big table where the books are on top of the table and it makes me feel kind of at home. And I realized with like a 3x10 foot space that I would have to shrink that table and figure out a way to put books up on the wall in a way. So I spent the week before the show kind of making a sign that would hang above me. Yep. And I wanted it to be true to brand in a sense. I had been thinking about a sign for a really long time. Like what I was going to do was I'm going to do cutout letters. I have a friend that's a graphic designer. And an artist himself. And I was like, how should I do this? And he was like, we could laser cut them. We were going through all these different plans. And I was like, I'm going to just make it. I'm just going to do it like I do the books. I'm going to transfer the pulp onto the wood. But, you know, it was like four foot, 2 inches to sign. It was really hard to get those individual letters to be straight and put them on. And it was very frustrating. And I was like, you know, trying to build that. Books were drying. And I was just like, okay, I'm just going to, whatever happens. We have this saying with my friends. We always say, trust the river. And usually it's a failure. We trust the river and we crash and burn every time. It's like, it's a disaster. But I figured, you know, like disasters are often the best things that happen to you, like in life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it sounds like you've been learning through trial and error the majority of your life here. So
yeah,
why not go through a trade show like that?
I feel the same exact way. I mean, all of it. I had no background in photography when I started in photography. Yeah. I had no background in journalism when I started in journalism. No background in cooking when I started in cooking. I mean, I like just jumping in and learning something. I feel like you know what you're made of. When I did the painting, I failed at it. And I knew almost immediately that it was just too, you shouldn't be doing something that you're supposed to be like, artist supposed to be creating something and be passionate about it. I only found when I was painting, I was so frustrated all the time. And that's not a place that I want to be. You know, like when I retired from being a journalist, I was like, I want to be, you know, I want to do something that feels as good as I felt when I took pictures, when I was in the middle of, you know, getting beat up by police and by, you know, people in protests. I want to do something similar to that. So I approached the show in that way. I was like, I'm just going to jump in and do it and set it up. And I got there the first day. And, you know, before when everybody else, I was looking around at all the booths and some of the booths were pretty intricate. People like built entire sets. Yep. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go with this and figure it out. And, you know, the most important focus is to be here and maybe do it again. And maybe, you know, see, you know, if this works for me. I had an interesting attitude toward it. I was excited and kind of depressed in a weird way because I was like, I looked at it and I was like, oh, I hope this doesn't fail. Like there was a lot of, you know, question of like in Soho, people love the books and I sell a bunch of books and stores that I mean, love the books. But now this is going to be a larger scale where lots of people from all over, the buyers.
You know, yeah. And it is a really great snapshot of your work and how it's perceived, not just by the individual, but regionally as well. I think you had a fairly good show. Why don't you talk about the buyers a little bit? Who did you meet?
Yeah. So on the first day, I remember sitting down. So this is Sunday. I remember the first day of putting down the paper and I was stitching and I was looking around and all the tables were kind of busy. People were like, it was like people were all around. Nobody was really coming to my table, but it was like 9:30. And then like 9:45 came and this first gentleman came to my table. And I was kind of taken by surprise. And I just went into like the mode of what I do on the street. And he asked me a couple of questions about the books. And then he was like, there's going to be a show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I looked at his tag and it was the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And I remember I was kind of like, okay, this guy's interested. And in my dream of going to the show, I was always like, imagine I got like, you know, I could get in a museum or something like that in a gift shop or, you know, somebody would recognize it from that. And here's this gentleman.
He wins. Look what happened, Robert.
And he's looking and he's going through it. And he's like, I really like these. And I was like, okay. And he was grabbing stuff and photographing stuff. And I was sort of overwhelmed. Other people started coming to the table at the same time, but I was focused on him and I was talking to him. And then I thought, well, do I have to be pushy? Do I need to say, okay, let's do this now. Pick your books and let's go. And I decided that I would not take that approach. I don't do it at the table. And, you know, like when I'm in Soho, I don't do it at any of the stores. I want it to be kind of true to who I am in it. Just let people kind of do what they, you know, what comes natural to them. And then other people were at the table and they were from other parts of the country. So there were people from, I guess the first people that came, they were from Westchester, Pennsylvania. And they bought 10 books. They spent a lot of time. I told them that each of the covers were individual and they were, you know, like unique. And that made them, I was like, you have to really go through all of them if you're picking. And they were picking the books and they were taking them down. And I was like, oh my God, how am I going to keep track of what's there? I know I could make a form of charging how much the book is, but they're not taking the books. So I had this roll of masking tape and I just was putting masking tape with a red Sharpie and writing their name in it. And writing soul.
Oh my gosh, Robert.
I didn't know. I didn't expect that I was going to sell anything. And then one after the other, people were coming to the table that morning. And between 9:45 and like 12 o'clock, I had already had three new stores that were carrying my stuff. And then a woman from Uncommon Goods came and visited me. And it was expensive for them. But we had a real conversation about it. And we talked about like, you know, about some of the other items that I had. I had these guest books and they more met their price point. And so it seemed like we don't have a deal with them yet, as of yet. but there was a real interest, and it was, you know, pretty moving for me, you know, like, and overwhelming at the same time, that there were like real places, and a place like Uncommon Goods, which is so large, to have an opportunity to even speak to a buyer, you know, like, and go, I mean, I had a hard time going to shops when I would bring the stuff, and or call somebody and say, I have journals, I want to bring them to you. They're like, no, we have plenty of journals. Don't come into the store, please. You know, you could send this through this email and do this, and that never goes anywhere. And all, and here you are in the middle of like a marketplace for this. And I guess even though I'm educated and have an understanding of how things work, I didn't really put two and two together that this is really what this is. It really is like you're just in a marketplace where people are there actually looking to stock their stores with stuff. And you really, it's a real window into what your future can be and what your future, you know, is currently.
100%. It's also a window into, you know, some of the conversations that we can have as New York Now with our new and emerging artists. And we are working on many programs so that perhaps the pathway in might be a little less unknown when you actually step foot on the floor. Tell us, what would you do differently now to prepare yourself for the next market?
Well, I think I kind of like the way it went. I would like it to look a little bit more my style. Like I'm not one to buy cheap shelves. Everything in my house is like 100 years old or older. You know, like I'm really into antiques and, you know, or building something that looks like an antique. You know, it was a stretch for me to go buy cheap shelves. They looked cool. They looked like they were supposed to be old shelves. But I think I would do that differently. But other than
they
that,
they did, Robert. By the way, they did. So just so you know, an outside eye, it really did look like your aesthetic.
Yeah, I think I felt that way. You're right. I'm hard on myself.
Sure.
But but I think that I wouldn't do much different. I think that it worked, and I think that one of the things about me as an artist and as a person is that if I think too hard about something that I'm going to do, it doesn't tend to come out all that great. There's a lot of missteps in it. And often when I just go with the organic way that things mm-hmm. kind of come together for me, it seems to work out best. I have a lot of passion. I'm like really into it. And I just feel like this is, you know, I don't know that I would do that much different. I would like it to look more like I wish it looked.
How about the way you work with buyers? Like how would you situate yourself so that perhaps because you've gone through it and you learn through trial and error. So what are the operational procedures that you might put into place or tools that you might equip yourself with now?
Well, I'm not sure if it was that people were gracious, the buyers and people out there were gracious because they realized it was my first time I did a show and they were tolerant of that. But I think that it went well the way that I was kind of slightly disheveled and that it is really a one-man show. And I think it kind of worked for the brand. And I don't know, like, I'm uncertain. Like, perhaps I'll go this route again and then I'll find, they'll be like, Robert, it's your second show. You should have known better. And think everything's a learning experience. Even when you're well-versed in something, you should always be willing to learn. So next time I go to the show, I might be a little bit more organized with how I handle people's, you know, like the way when they buy it, how maybe I'll have a sticker already designed so it looks a little bit more professional so they don't get a book that's coming to the store with a piece of, you know, masking tape.
Sure. Or maybe like a file so you don't have to write on masking tape with a red marker.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe? I like the Sharpie with the red marker. I like the concept of it. Now I made this intricate like ordering form that would get sent out. Like I wrote the, you know, in Acrobat. And I wrote it, it's like a sign and fill form, but that proved to be really difficult. So the first day after I got home, I rewrote it so that I could fill in the book names because they were a straight line. So little things, I think minor things, but I think overall for me, this the path that I took this time worked pretty well.
It sounds like it did. I mean, I think the thing that you'll continue to experience is that buyers are very tolerant, especially when it's somebody new coming into this field who may not have as much experience per se at a market. But you will also learn that the easier you make it for them, the easier it is to place an order. And that is ideally what the goal is. So I have no doubt that your disheveled mind is going to continue to evolve and revolve, I should say. And you'll perhaps think of things that might make it easier for you because your books are so unique. It's not like you're ordering one style and then ordering, you know, two dozen of them. If each piece is unique, your price point is different. And that really does elevate your product in a very lovely way, Robert. It really does. So the easier it is for the buyer to actually make that purchase or to understand from beginning to end what the process is, they can funnel that into their own operational systems in their stores, and it just becomes an easier process.
Yeah, I learned that from a very big buyer, from Uncommon Goods in particular, if I'm allowed to say. I don't know. She had said to me that she said, what would make it easier is the cost so high because of the time margin. She's like, you know, you could give us the lead times for stuff. And I was pretty fascinated by the fact that such a large operation was willing to you know, like work within the scope of what I'm capable of doing. And I was like, well, that's pretty interesting, especially since, you know, they don't even know what they're going to get out of this, right? So, you know, they're going to order 100 books, which is like their minimum, or 50 books, which is like their minimum in it. And they're not going to pick and choose, like going to the shelf and picking 50 books. They're going to have to trust that the quality and the integrity of what I'm doing is going to be there when they get that stuff. And I found it fascinating that they were so willing that they were so flexible with the way that they were running their own business. It made me really like them. It made me want to go out and tell everybody, even if they don't take my stuff, that that's a place that you have to go. And when I came back and told my sister, because my sister I share every aspect with, and she said that she'd been buying from Uncommon Goods forever, and then a lot of things that she's bought me through years are from there. And she was like, "Oh, these are great, you know, products. It's things like yours that, you know, that could be, you know, like available to people that would never get to see it." And I was like, "Oh my God!" It's like, you know, it's like I'm always learning.
It's amazing. That is kind of like a full circle story right there with your sister. If you think about it, that's beautiful.
Yes.
You know, also you get to also decide how you want to do your business, you know, how you want to sell, you know, and after working with a group or a buyer and you find that that particular style works well for you, you know, you just start working in that manner. There is no doubt that your product is not being seen as its own special, unique entity as it is. And so I just want to say congratulations. I think it's amazing that you made it through your first market, and I'm so proud of you, if I can say that.
Well, I really want to thank you for bringing me in. I mean, I really felt like I never would have. It's not something that I ever would have done on my own. I would never have made a decision or even thought about it. I was pretty content being on the street and doing it, and now I'm kind of thinking about it. I'm definitely going to do this next year. I would definitely do this every year. I mean, it's something, and I'm not like plugging New York Now. I'm plugging the experience.
It's okay. You can plug us, Robert. No problem.
but it really was. It was a great experience for me. And the overall, I was sort of sad. I remember the last day, you know, you become friendly with the people that are working next to you and talking to them about their lives. And it was like, you know, the last day of school, it reminded me of, you know, everybody was excited to get out of there, but sad that they were going to not see each other. And it's like, I met some new friends, and the experience was pretty, it was jarring, but it was a good experience. And I've been talking about it for like the last week while I build this bunch of books that I have to make for the Philadelphia Museum right now, which I'm so excited to be making the books for them. And the emails that I've been getting from the people that I sold to, I already shipped out the books, and people have received their books, and people are really excited to put them in the store. And they're, you know, it's really nice to get all the feedback from all these new people. And so I have a place in Chicago. I have a place in Mississippi that's going to be sending me paper, so I could do a collaboration with them. There's an inn upstate that wants me to make their menu cards. So there's other things that came from it, you know. And there's a jewelry person asked me if I can make. She saw my wooden cards, and she asked me if I can make wooden cards for her with her company. So it's like there's a lot of things other than just the books that were kind of, you know, birthed from this. And it really felt good. It really had a real reinforcement that, okay, this late in my life, I'm like 52 and I'm starting over, you know, it's a big deal. I mean, I was a journalist. I thought I was going to retire as a journalist, and things just didn't work out that way.
It just sounds like this has been a really great experience for you. It sounds like you took this on just as you take on life, and you kind of jumped in, you did it, you figured it out along the way. And look at where you've come now. I mean, you've made all these new contacts. You probably have a different vision as to some of the other items that you can create, or even start thinking about creating like those wooden cards that could actually be a whole nother element of your line.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, that's what the bookmarks became. The bookmarks were a giveaway for the show. So I wanted to give out something to people. It was a card. So it was a, you know, they're just a nicer card, you know. So I want people to be able to get that and have like a, you know, oh, this is 185. So I made the bookmarks, and now it's going to be a part of my product line where I could brand for people and do. And yeah, you never know. I mean, you never know what life brings you in a sense. And you came to my table that day, and that, you know, it brought me a whole other, you know, like lease on what I'm going to do for my future, you know, in my 50s. Really, it's a huge move. It's a huge step for me.
Well, it was meant to be. Are we still going to be able to find you on Prince Street, or are you
absolutely. I'm going to go. I'll be there this weekend. So I go out. Yeah, well, I like doing that. And truthfully, I do most of the sewing on the street because it's something I really don't like. I build here and I make the covers and all of that. The sewing is, I like doing it. It's therapeutic to some degree, but it's a real task. I mean, it's the same thing over and over.
I know. I watched you.
It's really just, it's a hard, you know, it's a constant. So being on the street for 8 hours in Soho and meeting people and sewing, I could produce a handful of books, like more than a handful of books. I mean, I got good at it. So I could sew a bunch of signatures together in the time that I'm out there. And I try to get out there on Saturdays and Sundays on the, you know, every week, but there's a lot of other things that come up that I don't get to do it. And I do it through the winter and I'm there out in the cold. I have a heater underneath the table, like a propane heater. And I like being out there, and it feels, you know, I have a lot of friends on the street there too.
Sure.
A lot of other artists, and it's nice. And it's a different portion of life now. It's a, you know, as a journalist, I got knocked around a lot, arrested a lot, and beat up a lot. You know, this is a different, you know, this is a different mindset. I go there and I sew, you know.
It's a very different mindset. Well, we're definitely not going to beat you up. We're just going to appreciate what you produce. And for those who are not in New York City and are going to walk down Prince Street to find you, where else can we find your products?
On my website at 185nyc.com, I have like a list of all the stores that carry my product. And if it's local to you, I prefer that you go local because I have stores around the country. And if you can't get it around the country, then pick one of those stores and order from them. It will help me sell in the future.
Absolutely. You heard it here. I'm really proud of you. I think it's amazing what you've done. And I'm so pleased that we crossed paths on that day and this is where we are right now. So I just want to say, I wish you the best. I want to thank you for sharing your life with us. You really did share a lot of your life with us and the path that you've taken into other countries and back again and all over the place to creating these amazing pieces of art. And that is what your product is. They are pieces of art. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing them with us and being a part of New York now and sharing your time with us today.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I really appreciate you coming to me.
Thank you so much for joining Robert and I today. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. I told you that he was full of energy and his passion for his work is more than evident, but you should definitely see it for yourself. So go to 185nyc.com, that's spelled out 185nyc.com, to see his hauntingly beautiful journals. But then definitely make it a point to look at his photography, as you will see how his hands are clearly an extension from what he saw through the lens of his camera. And you can view his work at nypress.org. So thank you again for joining us. And don't forget, New York Now is now an online 365 sourcing and connection platform. Make sure to sign up and sign in and definitely connect with me when you do. Thank you so much, and I will talk with you soon.
Thank you for listening to the New York Now podcast. Make sure to tune in weekly for engaging and insightful conversations touching on the most relevant topics facing our community today. Visit newyorknow.com to learn more about our market and how you can join in on the conversation.